Broadcasting live from a sacrificial wooden effigy, this is the Monstrous Feminine Podcast, the film club where we dissect the eerie intersections of gender in horror. My name is Mila, and I'm joined by the landlord's daughters,
Louisa,
Taya,
and Zeba.
This month, we're talking about folk horror. We will be covering the 1973 horror musical, The Wicker Man, directed by Robin Hardy, the 2019 film, Impetigore, directed by Joko Anwar, and the 2022 psychodrama, Ennismain, directed by Mark Jenkin. Before we get into the film, go ahead and follow us on Spotify, YouTube, or the Apple Podcasts app. You can find all of our links on our Instagram, at The Monstrous Feminine Podcast.
In The Wicker Man, Sergeant Howie is sent from the mainland to investigate the mysterious disappearance of a young girl on the Scottish island of Summer Isle after an anonymous source tips him off. As he investigates the case, he speaks to several townspeople and is shocked by the hypersexual pagan rituals which offend his conservative Christian beliefs. He soon discovers the town's plan to perform a human sacrifice on May Day to revive their harvest, and he suspects that the missing girl may be the intended victim.
But they are naked.
Naturally, it's much too dangerous to jump through the fire with your clothes on.
What religion can they possibly be learning? Jumping over bonfires.
Parthenogenesis.
What?
Literally, as Miss Rose would doubtless say in her assiduous way, reproduction without sexual union.
Oh, what is all this?
I don't know if this is true, but I never did a May Day. I don't know if y'all grew up doing May Day celebrations. It's perhaps not of all of our cultures, but if anybody has perhaps skipped around a maypole.
I did at school. I think when I was in like kindergarten or first grade, I'm pretty sure we did it because we would have like a little May Day parade at elementary school. It wasn't like human sacrificing. It was very, very chill.
Yeah, nobody was like blasphemous and pagan and like no moms rode in.
I mean, you go pretty much anywhere, like not in, like anywhere along the English coast or whatever, just basically not in a city. And people still celebrate May Day.
I don't remember the like maypole, but I remember May Day festivals and general kind of market type fairs. I remember it being like a significant thing when I was very young. And I don't think most English people do anymore. It's not how this country like reinvented itself geopolitically. Like everyone, they want it to feel very elitist and like royalty and James Bond is, you know, what defines us. So it's none of the like the actual indigenous cultures of the British Isles, which I think is funny.
What is May Day supposed to celebrate? Is it a harvest time? Is it the spring?
May Day is a European festival of ancient origins, marking the beginning of summer, usually celebrated on May 1st, around halfway between the spring equinox and the summer solstice. That's according to Wikipedia.
That makes sense, though, because if you think about it, it is in between what would make it would make a difference in the harvest. If you did something on May Day, you have enough time to turn it all around before you actually are harvesting things for the summer.
If you sacrifice the right person.
Oh, a key element of May Day is the burning of witches or the repelling and burning out with fire of evil forces. They do burn a wicker man in for midsummer in like some Scandinavian countries. I believe in Norway they burn, in Denmark they burn a wicker man.
It's odd to me that they would like have children across the UK and the US participate in May Day, but not explain it. Like, it just seems like an odd thing to want to keep around, to not like talk about any pagan origins. Like, I understand why they're not talking about it, but it's also like, why bother continuing the tradition?
To be honest, I really don't think many people understood what it meant or like what the holiday was for. I think they just thought it was a cute little thing to do. It's like a lesson plan thing when you're a teacher. Any arts and craft excuse seems great.
My little ass would have got tangled up in the ropes or the whatever they use, the ribbon.
The ropes.
Like, once they started doing those fancy crisscrosses, I know I would have been lost.
Would you vacation on this island?
I absolutely would.
I would sooner vacation on the one from the remake where it's women.
Wait, where is that set? I have no information on that.
It's great in the sense that it is very camp.
Oh, I love camp.
The Monstrous Feminine is on Twitter, so please go follow and tweet us. If you do engage with our content, you might just get a shout out in our next episode as Our Witch of the Week. This episode, Our Witch of the Week, is Into Margot, who tweeted us and said, "My favorite horror podcast doing an episode on Baccarat. So excited about this episode." Thank you, Margot. I love our Baccarat episode. It's probably one of my favorites. I hope you also enjoyed it. You've said that we're your favorite horror podcast. It's very sweet. Thank you. Was that your favorite episode? Like it is one of mine. That's what I want to know.
I think that's a fan favorite generally. People seem to like Baccarat.
Thank you so much, Margot. We really appreciate it. I love your name. I think it's very chic, by the way. I really enjoyed this episode, and I hope you do too. And if you have any thoughts about it, let us know.
Happy upcoming May Day in a few months. Just keep that in your heart until then. Friendly reminder that we are also on Patreon. For £1 a month, you gain access to our Discord. For £3 a month, you get to hear a cut discussion from our main episodes. And for £5, you get all that, plus the opportunity to pick our themes, films, and discussion points. Please support us. Any contribution helps.
Should we talk about the origin of folk horror as a term?
Yes.
Okay, once more with feeling.
Fuck,
Louisa,
yeah.
Could you tell us a bit more about folk?
Thanks, Ava. Wow, I got condescending participants with me today. But anyway, apparently the term was broadly popularized by Pierce Haggard, who is the director of The Blood on Satan's Claw. And he was describing in a 2003 interview with Fangoria magazine that his movie, The Blood on Satan's Claw, is a folk horror. And then Jonathan Rigby and Mark Gatiss, in a documentary series in an episode in 2010 called Home County's Horror, they then used the term. And they were talking about it in relation to a group of films which has since become known as a kind of unholy trinity of folk horror cinema, which is The Witchfinder General from 1968, The Blood on Satan's Claw, like I said, in 1971, and The Wicker Man, which we're talking about today, in 1973. Apparently, according to Gatiss, all of these films share an obsession with the British landscape, its folklore, and its superstitions. And Adam Scoville, who is a scholar in this area, has a book on folk horror, has characterized folk horror with like a few traits, which is one, that it's to do with the landscape; two, that it's to do with isolation; three, that it involves skewed moral beliefs; four, that it involves happenings or summonings. But there are also like several other traits that you might attribute to folk horror.
I love the term happenings. Like, if it has one rule, there have to be happenings and summonings and goings on.
On The Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, which is a documentary on folklore, there are several participants and interviewees kind of in this area who characterized it as such. One person literally said, "It's just weird things found in a field," which I thought was funny. It involves pagan conspiracies, pre-Christian beliefs. It involves rural locations. It involves kind of insular communities, which are often seen as backwards by whoever's entering, outsiders. It involves superstition, a kind of Freudian return of what's been repressed.
Maybe this can be applied to all of the films, but just like generally as the genre. I think I had a similar question for, I'm trying to think of the other theme where I'm like confused about the intention of it. Like, is it to make these rituals seem backward and like evil? Or is it meant to like throw shade on like Christianity or mainstream religion? I can't tell. Like, in a lot of these films, we have a massive list that we will or should share with our listeners of folk horrors and all the things that fall under the happenings of folk horror. I think a lot of them fall in this like weird gray area of like, I can't tell if the intent is like to make these pagan things scary or if they're like meant to like, oh, it was the voodoo episode where I was also like, is this meant to look, make voodoo look like scary and backward, or is it meant to make it look like a powerful force that could be used against your oppressor? Like, I think a lot of these sort of toe the line for me. And so I didn't know if the definition or the movies that we were considering, like originating the folk horror genre, like what was their intention? And is that wrapped up into the definitions that you found in your research?
Yours is a question with many possible answers. It's something I was going to bring up in relation, that exact question in relation to this film, because I do think it's really ambiguous. I think the Sergeant Howie, he literally plays the fool. A mockery is made of him. And I think it's actually a lot more ambiguous than like the pagan beliefs are, you know, silly or backwards. I think it's problematized quite a lot in these films. Interesting that you raise voodoo, because it's considered a kind of a subgenre of American folk anyway.
The intention and effect of these films in terms of how they portray paganism or the folklore of the particular place is case by case. Sorry to give a really boring, broad answer. And obviously, I think the like foundation of it is that it derives a lot of its fear or its sense of sort of foreboding and something that's quite menacing is from the folklore. But that's what, like, generally the only way I can describe folk horror is by vibes. And this is obviously basing off of British folk horror films, like very much of that tradition, a kind of slowish, nonsensical, a bit silly, but somehow has this very strange like menace to it, which feels very reminiscent of folk horror to me personally, that I can't really pinpoint. I'm just like, it's something about like how it portrays nature that feels very ominous, that kind of, it does sometimes get under my skin a bit, and not a very like explicit way than like other horrors we do, where you are very obviously disturbed. I think Midsommar is a really nice example of something that takes those traditions but actually amps up the horror in a way that I think folk horror can be quite mild, and not in a way that's like not effective, but just like it's a bit more vibes, you know. It's just vibes.
I agree that it's mostly on vibes. Like, it's very hard to characterize, because when it's to do with the folk, then it's like, well, there's folk everywhere and there are traditions and local superstitions everywhere. It's a very global genre as well, but we can get into that in a second.
I feel like specifically with this movie, it's not necessarily coming from like a shaming perspective. There's a message at the beginning of the film that is kind of acting as if it's a documentary, saying, thanks, Lord Summer Isle, for letting me come visit you and your people and observe your cultural practices. And I kind of think the relationship between Sergeant Howie and then the people and his Christianity versus their paganism is compared in a way that feels like cultural relativism. What he is shaming about them is just their culture, and there are practices like within Christianity that I think are also sort of seen as weird, like on communion, when you consume the body and the blood of Christ, of course it's a cracker and some grape juice or wine, but I think he keeps saying things to them like, this is uncivilized, or this is like savagery, and why are these people naked? And Lord Summer Isle kind of combats him with saying things like, well, this is what they learn in school, or this is their education, or these are our practices, and this is our culture. And he explains to him how the culture originated, but the sergeant is just like not very perceptive or even understanding of it in a way that I think makes him the fool, because he just refuses to see that there's another culture going on. He just continues to see things as though it should be the way that he's used to seeing them. And I think that is what makes him walk into the trap, because he doesn't even consider that maybe this little girl and her classmates and everything have been trained to be a part of this culture, and therefore she would be trapping him. He assumes that she wants to get out of here, and these people are manipulating her, and they're not her family, and they want to harm her, instead of thinking that he, the outsider, is the person who's being set up, and he is walking into a trap. Because he's thinking everything should work by the way that they do on the mainland. And like his ignorance, instead of his ability to perceive things as being relative to their own cultural practices, is what leads to his demise. There's sort of a commentary on capitalism in a way of them reverting to these practices because they have they transport all of their fruit and vegetables out. They make like a comment when the sergeant first comes and he asks for like fresh fruit and vegetables, that they send all of their fruit and vegetables off the island, and that's how they maintain getting money and being able to afford to live. And so the fact that they don't have these things then makes them resort to going back to the old ways and finding solutions through sacrifice. And it's basically to meet the demands that the mainland has for their fruit and vegetation, because otherwise they can't feed themselves and they can't make money through trade. And also the fact that the children, even though they're learning things differently, they don't seem to be like lacking education, but he is perceiving them as being behind because they aren't learning the things that they're supposed to. Or like the boys were outside dancing around the maple while the girls were in the classroom learning from the teacher. I think the gender roles are reversed a lot on the island, and that's also something that kind of trips him up and makes him continue to question Lord Summer Isle's ability to lead these people, because he thinks the boys should be learning more, or things should be going the way that he thinks they should.
I agree. I think like that key trope of the kind of ignorant outsider coming into the community is like one that's perhaps like the most defining trope of folk. Often it's in the guise of somebody who's like studying the community. Like we see that in Midsommar, but then they turn out to like, you know, be duped. So I think that there's a kind of almost trickstery element to it. Which means it's hard to come down on the side of either one of like who's fooling who or who's what. But anyway, I just want to do a brief, and I mean brief, because the list of folk horror is extensive and global. But these are some highlights. So I've mentioned the Unholy Trinity already, but it also, in British folk horror tradition, it also stemmed from a lot of television shows, like from the late 60s and 70s. So there's Whistle and I'll Come to You, Robin Redbreast. There was a television series which had a few episodes within it, which could be folk horror-ish, in A Ghost Story for Christmas. There's Penda's Fen, and there's Children of the Stones. And then more recently, there's some more modern British examples, which are like Kill List, In a Field in England, directed by Ben Wheatley. And then there's also The Ritual, directed by David Bruckner. And then some global highlights. And like I said, this is very brief, but I think even earlier than the Unholy Trinity, or like 1960s, 1970s, which is when we have like a really big explosion of like British folk horror, we can like take it to Sweden and we can see Haxan from 1922 or The Seventh Seal from 1954. There are Japanese examples. There's Koidan from 1964, or Onibaba from 1964, or Shikoku from 1999. There's Czech examples like Makarta Lazarova or Witchhammer. There's Russian examples like Vi or V. There's South Korean examples like The Wailing from 2016. There's German examples like Hagazusa, Heathen's Curse from 2017. There's a Guatemalan film called La Llorona from 2019. Australia has its kind of own folk horror, like often that's like reckoning with a colonialist legacy, either explicitly with like the last wave in 1977, or kind of more implicitly like with Lake Mungo from 2008, or there's Bedevil from 1993, which was directed by Tracy Moffat, and that was the first film directed by an Australian Aboriginal. Indonesia has its own lots of folk horror examples, like we're going to do in Pedagore later, but there's also Satan's Slave from 1980, or Mystics in Bali from 1981, or The Queen of Black Magic from 2019. And then finally, also, there's the United States. There's a few folk horror examples. So kind of more, I guess, quote unquote, I don't know, traditional, but there's Crowhaven Farm from 1970 or Children of the Corn from 1984. But you might also look at like Westerns as kind of a subsection of folk horror in and of itself, like traditional ones, but also maybe more modern ones like The Wind, which we've done on the podcast already. Films which are encountering a kind of quote-unquote declining South, and often like portray people from the South like maybe not as flattering. So films like Deliverance from the 1972, or even like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, are kind of potentially in the folk horror, American folk horror canon. As you kind of touched on, Zeba, there's like voodoo or hoodoo explorations, which are kind of folk horror-esque. Like we've done Eve's Bayou and The Serpent and the Rainbow on the podcast before. Finally, there's kind of modern examples like The Witch from 2015, directed by Robert Eggers, or Ari Aster's Hereditary and Midsommar. And those films have kind of brought about, not revival, because I think folk horror is strong and prevalent throughout cinema, but I do think they've put more of a spotlight on folk horror in recent years. But yeah, that's my kind of global whistle-stop tour of a folk horror canon. But we should post a watch list or a kind of more complete list on our Instagram, so go check it out.
That's a great list. Excellent, comprehensive list. And you going through all of those, especially the international examples. This thing about it's vibes-based. I'm trying to put my finger on the pulse of, like, what vibe it is. And I notice that, I mean, definitely, I think all of the, like, quote-unquote, like, what we would call, like, indigeneity-centered movies that we've covered, I would also put under the umbrella of folk horror. A lot of them, like, reckoning with, like, also colonialism and land from, like, the colonist perspective, I would also put under folk horror. So, like, there is this sort of, like, tie to the land, tie to, like, magic from, you know, ye old past that is, like, unknown to the protagonist, at least. Like, it's so old or so unfamiliar to them that, like, they are, like, reckoning with the folk horror. But the thing that sticks with me is, like, the vibes of it are, like, classic sleepover ghost story vibes. Like, I would call them, like, oral histories or, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think about why this is, like, so global and so far-reaching across cultures. The way, like, the beats of a folk horror are very similar all across cultures. And I just think that there's something very human about using, like, stories to, like, warn people about, you know, wandering into the woods, like, respecting the land, respecting your ancestors, you know, consequences of karma. Those are just very human, very universal themes. And if I think about, like, what makes a good scary story good, there's, like, that element of the unknown. There's sort of, like, the threat to my present position. Like, I'm really thinking about, like, going to camp. And this, I think a lot of camp horror can fall under these. And, like, being around a bonfire and, like, trying to scare all your friends. And it's usually a story that you heard from your older sibling or a camp counselor, or, like, it gets passed down. And all you remember are the beats. So there's a lot of different ways to, like, reinterpret a story. But as long as you hit those, like, beats of folk horror of, like, the isolation, the land, the magic, the connection to your present moment, it will always be satisfying, in my opinion. Like, and those are, like, the best stories that I hear from people or, like, remember from my childhood that have lasted with me. I've retold, they've been retold to me in different contexts. And I think that is, like, the true marker of excellent storytelling, but, like, more largely excellent, like, horror storytelling. And I think that's why this list is so long. It's because it's, like, a really, honestly, to me, pretty foolproof formula. It's like, hard to, like, make a bad plot out of, like, those very basic, very human, I know Taya has beef with some films we're covering, but, like, very basic, very human, like, patterns of storytelling.
I forgot to say as well, I forgot to say in my example listing off American folk horrors, I forgot to say, like, Candyman as well. Because I was going to say the thing that the quality of folk horror that I think is potentially the most, could be the most challenge is, like, the rural element. Because really what you're saying, Zeba, about the connection to the land, like, that is the most strong, the strongest element. But you might transpose that onto, like, a film like Candyman, which is about the connection to that, like, apartment complex and how that history seeps in to the present, or, like, is ever present because of that past. And she's also a scholar, the main character, who's going to study a community that doesn't really want to talk to her.
You have, like, all the basic things, but because it's in the city, I think it kind of gets skipped over as folk horror, but I think it fits, like, the basic things.
The horror that we see in, like, Midsommar and European horror is that all of the fear is derived really from a sort of more general sense of human beings being a little bit askew sometimes in the name of, you know, their culture or their beliefs. I don't think the people themselves are really portrayed in something that's very alien, but it's more like what they believe in. It's sort of like we could be the same, like the way that Howie tries to bargain with them, because it almost seems like he thinks he can kind of, you know, there's a bridge he can build between his Christian beliefs and their pagan ones. I just don't think that that's sort of the same thing we would see, like, in convincing someone that Candyman is folklore, because they're kind of, there's like a block, I think, in how we view traditions and folklore. I like British folklore, but I think a lot of it, I don't know, there's something, the way it feels quite silly, which I think works to elicit fear quite a lot of the times, but it feels, I think it's the campus thing. Like anything from the 1970s UK is just straight camp to me. We'll get into the musical aspect, the singing. Like, I think it works to kind of create this very surreal, absurd, strange atmosphere.
In your definition that you read about, like, it tying back to these explicitly British folk horrors, and like, that's the standard that we measure the other ones by, I think that is, to me, the most apparent, like, driving force of the first Wicker Man versus the remake, because the remake takes place in America, and the descendants of the people are in Washington. They're like in the Puget Sound area, but they're meant to be like descendants of Scottish people. So that's where they have this sort of like pagan connection. But they don't have the Christianity aspect really at all. The Nicolas Cage character is not like this fervent Christian. So the thing that was most apparent to me watching the old Wicker Man, which is, I had never seen it until we were watching for the podcast, I'd only ever seen the remake, is like, whoa, this is very British of him. His sense of sanity and his sense of morality is driven by like his Christianity. Like, he's like, how can we be a nation? How can we be a society? How can we run a school? How can we raise children without Christianity? Which is totally kind of absent from the remake. And I think that that is, in addition to it being like the 70s versus, I think, the early 2000s when the remake comes out. Like, I always love a 70s horror. I love that it's a musical. I didn't know it was a musical. What a ride I was taking on.
Wait, this is so Zabas thing. This is so Zabas kind of film. Why didn't I think about that?
Yeah.
I also did not know it was a musical, and I was actually pleasantly surprised. Usually I hate musicals. So.
What a gift. Every time they started singing again, I was like, yeah, another one. but also like that sort of like sense of whimsy is present in both. But it as Taya said before, like, the remake is so camp, and Nicolas Cage has a lot to do with that. But like, it's because it takes itself so seriously. Like, both films kind of take themselves so seriously in this way that like, it feels silly because we don't take like fear of the like barbaric pagan seriously, I think, anymore. Like, I was talking with folks I was watching the original with, and we were talking about like, this came out right before, right around Satanic Panic also, and like a lot of cult movies came out during this time, and there's something there that I haven't quite parsed out, like this seed of like religious mania, but also like 70s counterculture and like free sex, free love that was so present in the 73 Wicker Man that I just love. I eat it up. But like, it feels motivated by a very different thing, even though it's calling from the same like, quote unquote, like Celtic or pagan or like whatever. Like, the way that the symbology plays out in the American version versus the British version is not, to me, like 70s versus early 2000s. It is absolutely like how we see whiteness and paganness and Christianity. Ooh. In these two nations. And
I need to watch
like,
this
remake. You do need to watch the remake. It's some lines are like exactly pulled from the original, but it feels so different. Like, they're like, Nicolas Cage is clearly like a big fan of the original, and just like, it's a passion project, like, you can tell. But it plays out so differently, and I don't even know if he could put his finger on why. And to me, it's like the Britishness, the Christianity, like, through and through.
I kind of want to just touch on everything you guys have just said, basically, which is, I mean, you've just kind of pulled it together, but that kind of, I don't think there's any coincidence that during 1960s, 70s, like you said, Zeba, free love, counterculture, like hippie era, satanic panic era, we have like an explosion of these kind of folk horror, at least British folk horror films, which have come to be kind of genre defining. Because I do think there was so much off the back of that. There was a huge anxiety about, like, A, the kind of corruption of the youth. I am at, like, this is about when we start showing lots of sex on TV as well. Like, we see it in this film as well. Like, one quote from the sergeant is, like, everywhere I go on this island, I see degeneracy. And then he's like, and it stems from the schoolroom. And it does seem to be like this over concern about the innocence of the youth and like what values they might be internalizing, perhaps from what they're seeing. But it has a very sexual slant. And in the kind of Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched documentary, Piers Haggard, the director, said that he said that during this time he felt that chaos or violence or like a lack of discipline in the youth was like a key concern. And there was like panic about gangs and stuff. And also in that documentary, they cite like Mary Bell, who is like a child who murdered other children, two other kids when I think she was only 11. And there was just like this like panic about like the youth and innocence off the back of maybe like, you know, people experimenting with morals and stuff. I mean, that's just one side of it. The other side, Mila, you touched on like the kind of class element of it. The kind of what makes savagery. And it's like this fear in the psyche of Britain, which is like, we are just like a few decades or, you know, centuries. If we go back, then we will also be savages or we will also engage in this like animalistic behavior or something like that. Right. Like even in the film, like I think it's Lord Summerisle and he's like saying this quote and he's like, I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. None of them kneels to another or to his own kind that lived thousands of years. Not one of them is respectable or unhappy all over the earth. And it is like this like fear of that like animalistic nature of, or like connection to the land again, like if you kind of connect, these people might be closer to the land, they might be more animalistic. And it's like in direct opposition to a kind of British order. And the kind of documentary I mentioned does touch on that. It says like, this was a quote, but one of the ways folk horror rejects a kind of heritage film, like of the upper classes, is by making them seem completely monstrous and inhuman, like by putting them in close contact with the kind of pagan rituals. So I think that is the overwhelming anxiety. And I think the thing in these films that is interesting to me is how colonialist they feel, even though we're just in Britain. But like anytime you get like an outsider encroaching on a small community in like a land that they're not immediately familiar with, it does have colonialist implications for me. In these films, it's not necessarily racial because everyone happens to be white. In fact, that's one of the glaring things about it. But it does feel like there's this colonialist undertone of it. And I think in that documentary as well, they were like, the thing that colonists fear the most is being colonized. So it's like, it's no coincidence to me that there's all of these anxieties kind of emerging in folk horror cinema at this time, like you said, Zeba, about like nation making. It's why we have such like a Christian religious panic. It's like, what are the values? But at the same time, I think these films, like we've talked about, make fun of it and play with it, and like I can't quite see what side you're on at the end of it anyway. So it's just, I think it's just such a fascinating like subgenre of specifically British cinema in the context of this film. But yeah,
it's quite difficult to really like sort through the end of the film, and we were trying to discuss like how it's trying to paint this picture of paganism versus Christianity. Like, is there a sense that they are just these barbaric community and Howie is supposed to be the voice of reason, or is it that Howie is this sort of like, you know, ignorant, and to go so far, like Louisa, you were touching on, is this sort of like proxy of colonialists going into a community and saying that it's all backwards and trying to assert his cultural and religious dominance on them. But I think that actually a lot of the ways that Howie was sort of characterized to me, and the way that he was trying to bargain with them, and he was sort of, you know, screaming his Bible verses, I think that the film was painting him as something, quite like verging into sort of pathetic and a little bit, in a sense, hypocritical to be so dogmatic in his beliefs, because he was in a sense like so frustrated with this group. Don't get me wrong, they're trying to murder him. Listen.
His frustrations are somewhat warranted.
Slowly burning alive. But I think that the way they portray it to me feels like that they are kind of, they're showing him And I'm not saying it's meant to be ha-ha funny, but I think that, like, a lot of British films, it's a quite a neutral way of showing two sides. And I always thought, like, oh, Monty Python, it's so progressive. Look at the way it laughs at gender roles and, like, the sort of evils of feudalism and royalty. But then if you look at, like, the people that create Monty Python who are behind it, they're just, like, fucking conservative who boohoo about Me Too and, like, you know, wokeism. Because actually so much of British humour is really just a neutral stance, politically neutral, of a message, of a moral. I think that it's more meant to be like, ha-ha, look at this. It's sort of like intellectualized. Look at this funny difference or this funny similarity of these two like sides that are supposed to be different, but actually they're the same. And I wonder if there's a little bit of that going on at the end.
I think it's interesting how we've talked about in the past the link between sex and death. And I think this movie has a lot of links between that. When he first goes outside, there are people having sex in the graveyard. And there's a girl, like, naked, weeping, with her legs, like, open as if she's about to give birth on a grave. They have, like, a song that they're singing. They say, like, from the grave, like, the life will rise out of it. And they talk about the life cycle of rebirth over and over in the film. So I think, like, that link between the two was more obvious. Even, like, his attraction to Willow felt very much like a linking between him dying because it wasn't real for her. It was just a trap. But I think the thing that I thought was super interesting in the film was the scene with the beetle and the desk, because it pretty much is the plot of the movie. When he goes to look for the Rowan, I think that's her name. And he sees her desk where she would have been sitting, and all the kids are saying they don't know her. And then he looks in the desk and it's the beetle on the nail with the string. And the girl says, like, poor thing, it doesn't realize that no matter what it does, it's going to keep going around in the trap over and over and end up right against the nail. And he is like, then why do you keep doing it? And she doesn't even get a chance to say anything before he, like, is like, oh, I can't believe the improper things you teach these children.
I mean, they were doing animal cruelty in the classroom. I would have been distracted as well.
Because it was in Rowan's desk, it's basically like Rowan is literally the thing that is making him go around and around in the circle, and he's always going to end up right in the trap. And if you aren't aware of, like, the story, if you've never had any background of it, that's the moment where I think you immediately kind of clock that he is going to be the person to die in this movie and that he is in a trap.
Wouldn't you know at the beginning? I feel like people would know.
But I didn't think his Christianity, like, seemed weak to me. It seemed as like him being so fierce in his beliefs was sort of like a foil to them being so fierce in their beliefs. So you have two people who are absolutely unwavering in what they believe in. So they can't agree on anything, and they think the other is wrong. But honestly, I think with the residents of Summer Isle, they are a bit more receptive to thinking he's allowed to think whatever the hell he wants, versus he is very, like, gung-ho that everything they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, when Lord Summer Isle is, like, there's, like, young schoolgirls dancing around, like, naked around the fire, and when he, like, and when Sergeant Howie is, like, he's, like, yeah, isn't the sight of youth, like, refreshing or something like that? And I was, like... And then Sergeant Howie's like, no, as in I'm not a pedophile. So that was, like, really weird. And I think, like, as in a lot of these folk horrors, which are so obsessed with fertility, we also get, like, you know, a potential victimization of women.
I don't know. It's I feel like it's implied that, oh, well, she's, like, trying to fuck him through the thing. But, like, the virgin difference is also a big difference to the Nicolas Cage thing. Like, her trying to seduce him and he is, like, trying to remain, like, celibate until marriage. Like, that knowledge in the back of my mind versus, like, Nicolas Cage, who's already, like, fucked and had a kid, like, by the time the movie starts, that he had to be a virgin to sacrifice. But the virgin sacrifice is never a man. It's always a woman. So I just thought that was interesting.
I wanted to pick back up on your comment on neutrality and stuff, Mila. I think part of the reason this film's kind of harder to categorize or, like, to decipher its sense of morality is also because of it's like weirdly a genre-defining film, but, like, also hyper aware of a genre that kind of has yet to be established. It's kind of an odd thing. Like it's kind of acknowledging the fabrication of folklore. And I think like folklore as like a thing is, of course, it's based on like common supernatural elements. Like we often get like a witch or like local legend or whatever, but then it's often made up, like a lot of it's made up by the community. Like a lot of it's twisted, or like the community's interpretation of that thing, which might not actually be based in fact or XYZ. And I think that's really interesting, like, thing to consider, particularly with this film. And in an essay by Dawn Keatley, she quotes Adam Scoville, who says that folk horror often creates its own folklore. And she goes on to say, in evoking folklore in order to reattach it to the local, the provincial, the rural, folk horror participates in what Gunter Smidgens describes as folklorism, which names a self-conscious use of folklore for particular ends. And then she's quoting here, but folklorism is the conscious recognition and repetition of folk tradition as a symbol of ethnic, regional, or national culture, end quote. Folklorism represents a folklore self-consciously, accepting it as a carrier of the past and the pre-modern world and bringing an impression of unchanging, stable tradition into the present. Folk horror does not just accept folklore as a carrier of the past, however, but actively creates it as such. Indeed, some folk horror texts not only themselves serve as folkloristic practice, but also represent an ongoing practice of folklorism within the diegesis. In The Wicker Man, for instance, the current Lord Summerisle perpetuates folk traditions while being quite aware that his grandfather invented them expressly in order to control the islanders. While the islanders appear to believe in the status of their rituals as real, Summerisle knows that they are not, although he governs as if they were. So, yeah, I think that adds that, like, and this is me talking now, end quote, but I think that adds like a layer of complexity when we're interpreting it, because you kind of know, as the audience, you know, through Lord Summerisle that like he straight up kind of he like manipulated these people. He talks about in his monologue about it, he says he gave them, his grandfather decided to, let me read the quote actually. He says, with typical mid-Victorian zeal, he set to work. The best way of accomplishing this, so it seemed to him, was to rouse the people from their apathy by giving them back their joyous old gods. And yeah, so basically he just wanted to, you know, an access to like a population that would labor for him. So he decided to like tap into the folklore, pagan traditions in order to like mobilize them in the way that he saw fit, or best fit. And I think that's really interesting. So it's hard. It's also hard in this film because you know that the people themselves have been manipulated into like celebrating that kind of harvest tradition, but then they also wholeheartedly believe it and it seems to have like real effects for them. So it's hard to know. But I think it adds another layer of like who's being mocked, because in that context, then, you know, Sergeant Howie isn't just the butt of the joke. He isn't just the fool, even though he plays it, because they've also been manipulated, but then he ultimately dies. So I guess he kind of lost that round. But also on the notion of folklorism being something that's partially created, apparently like when doing research for this like script writing it, Robin Hardy based it on like books like by The White Goddess by Robert Graves or The Golden Bow by James Fraser. These books were kind of source material, but then scholars actually debate the authenticity of these texts in describing like traditions, folklore traditions. So like it's since been like criticized. For example, as mentioned in the Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched documentary, the idea of the Wicker Man itself, it's not actually, I guess, guaranteed that these effigies existed. Apparently like it does appear in like Roman texts, but it's possible that it was propaganda to like make, you know, the people there seem barbaric or something. So yeah, it's kind of interesting how even right down to like the textual level of the film, there's a kind of question of authenticity or belief or like morality or like truth, really, basically.
I liked that you went back to Lord Summerisle's sort of motivations, because I had kind of skipped over it. And it does sort of like reaffirm for me that kind of one, the sort of camp aspects. I know we're saying Nicolas Cage remake is super super camp, I do not deny it, but I read so much of like this era of like, British filmmaking is very camp, and a lot of that is these sort of almost pantomime evil bad guys, which I think Lord Summerall like does become, because we find out, like you said, that he sort of orchestrated this cultivation of folklorism back to the island in order to like fulfill his own sort of greed desires to sort of create lots of profit for the island. Well, maybe he had, you know, good intentions on some level, whatever, but that could be, I think, a way that people like read the film therefore is some kind of commentary on that, is like digging down deep into the ways that not only religion but also these pagan traditions can be exploited by people in power to, like you said, mobilize laborers or, you know, control cultural ideals, mindsets. And I'm sure it does. Like, I'm sure people could take that away from the film, but I think that it just, again, it reminds me how much actually, I'm gonna say English because I don't want to say British as a sort of blanket term, like English media and, I mean, yeah, like film, TV, anything sort of with a satirical slant, which I think basically most English things have. Okay, it's sort of the equivalent of those comedians who, there's like observational comedians who stand up and they're like, it's my job to make you uncomfortable. You know, it's my job to make you think about things. And I think that so much of English comedy is sort of built on that premise of kind of challenging ideas for the sake of challenging ideas without a kind of follow through of a political ideology attached to them. Or even if it's like, yeah, obviously it's bad to exploit people.
You sound like Vanessa Hudgens talking about COVID. Sorry.
People are gonna die. Like that's what it feels like to me sometimes with these films, is that it's very much like the, it's hard to explain. I'm finding it difficult to like break it down, it, like as I'm talking about it. But it's like this mocking slant of things that basically like the end goal is more humor, and it's more like trying to get the audience to sort of to laugh at the audience to think that they've been duped into, you know, look how silly you are and your beliefs, rather than a kind of, I don't think, like so many things don't feel as politically charged in like English filmmaking. And that's not true. There is lots of like, you know, social realism and kitchen sink dramas that obviously take a look at working class communities as a way to like demonstrate all the ways that the governments over the fucking decades have like ruined rural England. But I think that, and not just rural, like, in the city as well. But I just think that it's so hard for me to like, just going back to the beginning where we like questioned, like, what is this film saying about paganism? What is it saying about the folklore in this film? Is it painting it in this sort of negative, positive, neutral? And I find it so difficult to really like determine that.
I think this genre does present a lot of the cultural anxieties of the time, but yeah, it is interesting how it's doing all of that, and yet we still don't know. It's not coming down on the side of anything. It's like political, or so imbued in like the kind of politics, like kind of unconsciously, to then like have some sort of like moral resolution. And it's just interesting that it just kind of doesn't, because yeah, even their leader, and Lord Summerall makes some decent points about Christianity. Like, I think it's because you said, Taya, like they, that like Sergeant Howie's like really judgmental, but Lord Summerall is also quite judgmental of Christianity and quite critical, but only kind of in response to Howie's like hostility. But still, like he says about when Howie says something about their fake biology, fake religion, Lord Summerall said, and then he says, like you said, Zeba, have the children never heard of Jesus? He then says, himself, the son of a virgin, impregnated, I believe, by a ghost. That was such a good line. But like I said, I think we are presented with like, it's kind of, I mean, it's often, I think like folk horror is, it's always, and I'm going to use the word and we're going to hate me for it, but it's always in like a liminal space. It's always like, we are just meeting at like some interaction, past, present, like pagan Christianity, like there's some sort of interaction happening, but there's not necessarily like a compromise or resolution that's actually made. It's like presenting it with like no, like, final deciding thought.
Thank you for listening to the Monstrous Feminine podcast, produced and hosted by Zeba Aurora, Taya Burnett, Mila F., and Louisa Johnson. Big thanks also go to Sebastian Pizarro for our wonderful theme music. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, SoundCloud, and Spotify at the Monstrous Feminine Podcast and on Twitter at the Monfem Pod. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and follow us on TikTok at the Monstrous Feminine Pod for podcast clips and more fun. All information can be found on our website, www.themonstrousfemininepodcast.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Brooms up, witches out.